Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
The UK election result spells bad news for the EU and Brexit. By Charlotte MacDonald Gibson. Europhiles in Britain awoke Friday morning with a rare feeling of optimism, hopeful that the poor electoral result for Theresa May's Conservative Party and gains for Labour and the Liberal Democrats could mean a softer exit from the European Union, or even better, a reversal of Brexit. But for the officials at the EU headquarters in Brussels and European leaders, May's election flop complicates yet further an inevitable process which they simply want out of the way. Almost a year has passed since Britain voted to become the first country to leave the EU. Although it was a decision which saddened many across European capitals, officials have accepted the result of the democratic vote. They have, however, watched the events in Britain with increasing dismay. First came infighting among Conservatives about the kind of Brexit they wanted and unrealistic expectations about the deal they could get, then an election campaign in which May took personal aim at Brussels and accused the EU of meddling in the polls. Now her gamble has backfired, and she has lost her majority in Parliament. "It is to a certain extent a nightmare, the worst-case outcome," says Jant Kao, director of the Richard C. Holbrooke Forum for the Study of Diplomacy and Governance. "This will create, in one way or another, a weak British counterpart in the negotiations, and that is the nightmare. European governments want a counterpart that they can rely on, and now they have the worst of all options. They don't have a government with a decisive majority. They have one with a weakened mandate and uncertainty about who is in charge." The EU's treaties lay out a strict timetable for withdrawal. From the triggering of Article 50, which May did on March 29th, before she called the snap election, there's a 2-year period to negotiate terms of the exit. Issues such as the outstanding bill the UK must pay and how the deal with EU citizens in Britain and Britons in the EU must be resolved before talks begin on a new free trade deal. While May has rebuffed calls to resign and is confident of forming a governing partnership with Northern Ireland's DUP party, there's no clear idea yet of how the election result may have affected her negotiating position. Official talks with the EU are due to begin on June 19th, but that timetable is looking increasingly unrealistic. For Anthony Gardner, the former U.S. ambassador to the EU and now a visiting fellow at the Robert Schuman Center of the European University Institute, the sheer difficulties a weakened new government will face could end in the hardest Brexit of all, the negotiating period ending with no agreement. That would mean Britain reverting to trade tariffs under WTO rules and many other economically damaging measures, such as disruptions to air traffic control and customs checks. In a government that is so divided, are they going to be capable of really getting a policy, negotiating, and really sticking to it? Says Gardner. For the optimists, an election result with greater representation in Parliament from left-wing Labour and pro-EU Liberal Democrats means more voices challenging May's hard Brexit vision, in which she wants to leave the single market. May has to get the Brexit deal through Parliament, and therefore could be inclined to go for a softer deal. But as Gardner warns, without getting the strong majority she wanted, May remains beholden to the Eurosceptics in her party. She's still going to be faced with her pretty significant rump of Tories who are hard, and yet she is going to be leading a minority government that is divided. And I think the clock may just run out, he says. On Friday, officials in Brussels swiftly made clear that the clock is ticking and that they are ready to go. While Britain has been in a state of Brexit chaos, the EU has been the picture of calm, appointing a chief negotiator and publishing detailed negotiating guidelines. "As far as Commission is concerned, we can open negotiations tomorrow at 9:30, quipped Jean-Claude Juncker, president of EU Executive Branch, the European Commission. A similar tone came from Donald Tusk, president of the European Council, which represents the 28 EU heads of government. "We don't know when Brexit talks start," he tweeted. "We know when they must end. Do your best to avoid a no deal as a result of no negotiations." For those hoping that the elections may spell an end to Brexit, that option is not really being considered in Brussels. The leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, made clear during the campaign that he would respect the referendum result, and EU leaders have always questioned his commitment to the European project. His very half-hearted pro-European stance has never looked quite convincing to people here, says Takau, who is based in Berlin. My feeling is that the election result is not going to derail Brexit. It is only going to make more of a mess of it.
A popular hair loss drug costs 40% more for women than men, by Amanda McMillan. Dr. Jules Lipoff was browsing the pharmacy shelves of his local Target when he stumbled across an interesting finding. Ounce for ounce, the women's version of Rogaine foam, an over-the-counter treatment for hair loss, costs significantly more than the men's. Men's and women's Rogaine are marketed differently but contain the same ingredients. I thought, maybe this is just a fluke, says Lipoff, assistant professor of dermatology at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. But I went to a couple different stores and saw it was pretty consistent. Lipoff and his colleagues then compared prices for Rogaine and its generic version, minoxidil, at 21 pharmacies in 4 states. Their findings, published in JAMA Dermatology, show that the drug is routinely priced higher when marketed for women. Although they only looked at a specific selection of products, the authors say their paper may reflect the larger issue of gender-based pricing for many types of health care. The researchers included Target in their analysis, along with 5 of the country's other largest chain pharmacies, CVS, Kroger, Rite Aid, Walgreens, and Walmart. From July to November 2016, they recorded the prices, sizes, and ingredients of 41 unique minoxidil products at stores in Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, and Indiana. Rogaine's foam formulas are the company's newest, most popular products, and at 5% strength, they are FDA-approved for both men and women. But despite having identical formulations, the researchers found a 40% average increase in the price of the women's foam version, $11.27 per ounce, compared to the men's, $8.05 per ounce, when sold at these stores. Lower-cost generic versions of minoxidil foam are available, but these products are branded for men only because Rogaine still owns a patent on the women's foam formula. A spokesperson for Rogaine told Health that Rogaine foam for men and women are the same price per ounce when purchased directly from the company's website and when sold wholesale to pharmacies. "I can't speak for pricing by individual retailers," he said in an email. A spokesperson for Target said the company was not able to respond by press time. The researchers also looked at topical liquid minoxidil, which is available for men and women as Rogaine or a generic. It's an older version of the medicine and is sold for men at 5% strength and for women at 2%. In this case, even though the men's formula has more active ingredient, the two versions cost about the same, $7.61 on average for women's and $7.63 for men's. On one hand, we see that women are paying more than men for essentially an identical product, says Lipoff, and on the other, we see that they're paying the same as men for something that's not as effective. Lipoff points out that women's and men's versions of these products are sometimes sold in different sizes and quantities, so women may not even realize they're paying more. To add to the confusion, Rogaine foam is approved for women as a once-daily treatment and for men as a twice-daily treatment, so the same size container is labeled as a 2-month supply for women and a 1-month supply for men. But doctors may tell women to use the medicine twice a day for better effectiveness. They may also tell women to buy the men's 5% topical formula instead of the women's 2%. Lipoff tells his female patients to buy men's Rogaine because it's cheaper. "I would also encourage them to seek out generic versions, whatever is least expensive, because the active ingredients are going to be the same," he adds. Gender-based price differences are not new. One 2015 report found that women pay more for personal care products 56% of the time. But since few medications are marketed differently to men and women, it isn't often that researchers can compare drug costs in this way. Lipoff says the purpose of his study wasn't to accuse stores of intentional discrimination, but simply to document and make people aware of the real difference in cost.
I also hope we can bring forth a larger issue, he says, that we should consider how many of our costs in health care, not just medications, but things like insurance and medical procedures, could be affected simply by gender.
10 Ways to Get Ready for Game of Thrones Season 7 by Megan McCluskey. Warning, this post contains spoilers for Game of Thrones. With a July 16 premiere date, the first episode of the eagerly awaited 7th season of Game of Thrones is drawing ever closer. But for those who have been counting down the days since the June 2016 Season 6 finale, these last few weeks may seem like the longest yet. Luckily, there are a number of ways to pass the time that will not only refresh your memory about everything that's happened in Westeros over the past 6 years, from the beheadings to the weddings to the resurrections, but also get you even more excited to return to George R. R. Martin's world of fire-breathing dragons and White Walkers. Here are 10 ways to deal with your Game of Thrones Season 7 anticipation. Number 1. Binge-watch the most essential episodes. For those who don't want to spend 60 hours rewatching every episode from the beginning, there's a solution. Time's Guide to the 20 Most Essential Episodes will help viewers binge the series in a third of the time it would normally take while still hitting most of the major plot points. Number 2. Imagine what could have been. Several key Westerosi players, from Jon Snow to Catelyn Stark to Loras Tyrell, were nearly played by different actors, meaning the fabric of the hit HBO drama as fans know it had the potential to be drastically different. Here's a comprehensive list of stars who were almost cast on Thrones. Number 3. Revisit Arya's kill list. With several people on her list still alive and mostly well, Arya has her work cut out for her over the course of the final two seasons. Here are the names and crimes of everyone she intends on gifting to the many-faced god. Number 4. Reminisce about a long-lost character. Although Gendry, played by Joe Dempsey, has been absent from Game of Thrones for over 3 seasons, some viewers speculate he may soon be making a reappearance. Robert Baratheon's only surviving child was last seen escaping Melisandre's clutches with the help of Ser Davos Seaworth in the Season 3 finale, a suspiciously inconclusive ending for a character who once played a significant role. But thanks to clues from George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire books and a recent alleged sighting of Dempsey in the Belfast airport, fans are speculating that Gendry still has a major part to play in the events to come. Number 5. Find hidden clues in old Nan's tales. She may only have a handful of scenes in the Game of Thrones TV show, but in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire books, Old Nan, House Stark's oldest servant, may have long ago foreshadowed a major key to the series' end. When Bran is paralyzed from the waist down after being pushed out of a Winterfell tower by Jaime Lannister, he spends quite a bit of time in bed listening to Old Nan's stories. But while he mostly takes her anecdotes with a grain of salt, there seem to be clues about both the past and future, and his connection to them, in much of what she says. Number 6. Learn about the history behind the Great War. Thrones seems to have been teasing the impending conflict between the living and the others since the series' very first scene, when 3 rangers of the Night's Watch are attacked by a White Walker beyond the Wall. But to truly grasp what's at stake in the show's final 2 seasons, it's important to understand the history of the White Walker's relationship with the people of Westeros. Number 7. Explore Jon's family tree. Following the revelation that Jon Snow is not Ned Stark's bastard, but rather the son of his sister Lyanna, in the Series 6 finale of Game of Thrones, viewers were left wondering about the identity of the former Lord Commander's father. However, they didn't have to wait too long to find out the answer, as HBO released an infographic that seemed to confirm the popular R plus L equals J theory. That is, that Rhaegar Targaryen is actually Jon's dear old dad. But before we start speculating about what this news will mean for Jon going forward, let's take a look at how it affects his familial situation. Number 8. Speculate about a potential romance. This confirmation of the fan-favorite R plus L equals J theory almost certainly sets the stage for Daenerys and Jon to come face-to-face in Season 7, a meeting many believe will reveal the meaning behind the title A Song of Ice and Fire, and potentially lead to a marriage between the two. Number 9. Laugh at the Internet's best Thrones jokes. To keep things light as the long-awaited winter descends, here are 18 of the most hilarious memes Thrones has given rise to during its 6-season run. And number 10, enjoy a detailed breakdown of the Season 7 trailer. Season 7 will be a mere 8 episodes, and Season 8 just 7 episodes. That means that the writers will speed plot lines along and resolve the mess that is Westeros. The new footage suggests that Cersei Lannister and Daenerys Targaryen will clash while Jon Snow contends with the threat of White Walkers in the North. It also drops a number of hints about the fates of characters like Jaime, Jorah, and Arya. To decipher it all, we did a second-by-second breakdown of the trailer. You're welcome.
Spiro Agnew's lawyer: How the Russia Leaks Could Backfire in Court, by Martin London. London is a retired partner for the international law firm Paul Weiss Rifkin Wharton & Garrison, which he chaired from 1990 to 1992. He was a principal lawyer defending Vice President Spiro Agnew against criminal charges relating to bribery charges. His clients have also included Jacqueline Onassis, and he is the author of The Client Decides. Our press is proud of its open hunt for government secrets. Reporting them is highly rewarding. Images of Woodward and Bernstein dance in the heads of journalists for publications large and small. The audience loves it and applauds the winners. The subjects, as in the losers, whine about leaks and watch the simultaneous emergence of the truth and the decline of their power. But amidst the celebration, there are important questions being forgotten today with regards to the investigation into whether the Russian state colluded with the Donald Trump campaign. They go beyond the charging of an NSA contractor for allegedly sharing classified intelligence. For one, what happens when agents or agencies of the government leak information, be it true or false, that may affect the result of a criminal inquiry into the subjects? How can a grand jury make a reasoned decision when it is deluged with government-sourced leaks even before that jury is selected and sworn? Some of Trump's former colleagues, Paul Manafort, Michael Flynn, Carter Page, et al., come to mind. All are certainly going to be at the center of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's focus. All face the risk of grand jury indictment. And yet, if Mueller impanels a grand jury, can that body distinguish what it has read and seen from government-sourced leaks from what is later presented to them in licit proceedings? Have the leaks already seriously handicapped Mueller if he chooses to go the grand jury route? History teaches us the answer may be yes. In 1973, Vice President Spiro Agnew was the target of a massive barrage of leaks asserting he had taken pay-for-play bribes when he was governor of Maryland. Dozens of newspaper articles reported alleged details of the Maryland U.S. Attorney's investigation. The press reports sourced the information to, quote, Justice Department officials and senior government officers. I co-represented Agnew in the case, and when discussions between our team and the Department of Justice broke down, Attorney General Elliot Richardson announced he was about to submit evidence to a grand jury. We moved to stop him from doing so. We argued the plethora of government leaks had fatally compromised the criminal inquiry. The district judge appointed to handle the matter, Walter E. Hoffman of Virginia, was clearly upset by the leaks. He crafted a special grand jury charge in which he said, "We are rapidly approaching the day when the perpetual conflict between the news media, operating as they do under freedom of speech and freedom of the press, and the judicial system, charged with protecting the rights of persons under investigation for criminal acts, must be resolved." But how? The judge said that in the face of the government's denials of the leaks, he was not prepared simply to accept the reporter's government source attributions. We made a proposal. We would put both sides under oath, the government and the press. We had prepared a written order giving us the right to depose specific Department of Justice officials, as well as a group of reporters who had written stories saying the source of their information was Department of Justice officials. The U.S. Attorney's team was apoplectic at the notion of these unprecedented depositions. While they howled, the judge signed. This put the government in a pressure cooker. The Justice Department tasked the FBI with investigating more than 100 Department of Justice personnel, all of whom signed affidavits they had not leaked. But either one or more of them were lying, or the score of reporters covering the story were. I believed the reporters, and so did the judge. The press, of course, went berserk at the prospect of being obliged to answer our questions under oath, and reporters and their prominent publishers threatened to accept jail sentences before they revealed sources. But as far as we were concerned, they already had revealed their sources. It was all right there in the first paragraph of their published pieces. Their source was Department of Justice officialdom. We would have made our case by just asking whether, when they wrote that their source was the Department of Justice, they were telling the truth. There's no way they could have legally avoided answering that question. Jail was in the foreseeable future. In the end, the safety device on the pressure cooker blew. Every person in the Justice Department with knowledge of the investigation had sworn to the FBI they had not leaked. Obviously, one or more had lied, and the government recognized it. Their people faced perjury charges, reporters faced contempt sanctions, and the government faced the risk its leaks had fatally infected the case against the vice president. The result was the government yielded to the pressure and agreed to permit Vice President Agnew to take a nolo plea, to accept a conviction without admitting guilt, and to resign with a light fine. That was it. The press, of course, was outraged. What great irony! They had taken the government's handouts, which provided the factual basis for our move to achieve the exact result they denounced. Leaks are a double-edged sword. They inform the public, but prejudice the fair trial rights of those under investigation. We never have resolved the conflict between the First Amendment rights of the press and the Sixth Amendment rights of those who are the subject of press scrutiny. While the press may have, quote-unquote, convicted Manafort, Flynn, Page, et al. On the front pages, they may have, at the same time, effectively immunized them from prosecution.
This new Lord of the Rings game looks even crazier than the last, by Matt Peckham. The more we see a bad guy like Sauron on screen, the less interesting he becomes. In Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, he was little more than a whisper. The shadow behind shadows, a boogeyman so beyond the ken of even the great powers who got what he really was that even they didn't care to mention him. My favorite scene from the Peter Jackson film is in the extended cut of The Fellowship of the Ring, during the Council of Elrond, when Gandalf invokes the Black Speech. The very air darkens, and everyone's reaching for a Tums. So I'm conflicted about Monolith's new Middle-earth Shadow of War story trailer, which includes Jackson's Iron Maiden album Escapee, All Rasping and Release the Hounds. That You versus Sauron plot was Shadow of Mordor's least interesting aspect. Sure, writer Christian Cantemessa did a fine job dutifully aping the arcane fatalism of the Jackson films, but the premise was dippy. A superhero ghost pals up with a zombie ranger to knock off some preening henchmen and eventually Sauron himself. The game, by contrast, was incredible. One of Time's top 10 that year. The bright what? Talion Celebrimb who? Who cared? What worked was Monolith's delightful, pliable AI sandbox, which, when nudged, pushed back, often punitively. Shadows of War, its sequel for PC, PlayStation 4, and Xbox One that's due October 10th, may be even grander in that regard. And look, there's Shelob and the Nazgul. And a new ring of power. And a Balrog wearing a helmet. Come for the nerdy Tolkien greatest film hits theme park rides. Stay, with any luck, for the guileful, taxing, dynamic bad guys in an open world said to be even more nuanced than the last. Five underrated structures designed by famed architect Frank Lloyd Wright by Eric Jenkins. Frank Lloyd Wright is often recognized as the greatest architect in American history. If not that, he's certainly the most famous. But while Falling Water and the Guggenheim are ingrained in the minds of any casual design enthusiast, few are aware of the full extent of Wright's catalog. The Wisconsin-born planner designed more than 1,000 structures, 532 of which were completed. Compared to Wright's more iconic buildings, some of those don't always get the praise they deserve. As the world celebrates Wright's 150th birthday, June 8th, take a look at five underrated structures the famed architect designed. Malcolm Wiley House, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Constructed in 1934 in the midst of the Great Depression, the Wiley House was Wright's first house designed specifically for the middle class, according to its website. Commissioned for a mere $8,000, just under $150,000 today, Wright's design was more modest compared to previous works, but provided the architect a creative breakthrough and precious finances at a time when much of America was in poverty. Equipped with a spacious floor plan that merged the living and dining room areas, separated behind a glass panel stacked with shelves, the Wiley House could have gained more prominence had Wright's most famous design, Falling Water, hadn't been commissioned as his very next project. Samuel Freeman House, Los Angeles, California. Part of a series of textile block houses Wright designed for the Hollywood Hills in the 1920s, the Freeman House faces stiff competition from its more famous siblings like the Ennis House. All four textile block houses were completed around 1924, but the Freeman House was smaller than the others, harder to find, not open to the public, and largely absent from contemporary pop culture, curbed rights. But the Freeman House deserves recognition of its own. Its Mayan-inspired block patterns are unique, and the building's wraparound miter-cut windows were like one of the first of its kind. Yodoko Guest House, Ashiya, Japan. Wright did most of his work in the U.S., but several times he took commissions outside of the country. The Yodoko Guest House was one of them and remains the only surviving residence designed by the architect in Japan. Built atop a hill in Ashiya, the summer villa's exterior bears similarities to the Los Angeles textile block homes. It's no coincidence that the guest house was also completed in 1924. Japan recognized the beauty of the structure, designating the building as an important cultural property in 1974. But the home often gets left out as one of Wright's great works due to its location outside of the U.S. Price Tower, Bartlesville, Oklahoma. Dubbed one of Wright's most bizarre buildings ever by The Atlantic, Oklahoma's Price Tower is certainly one of the more recognized projects by the architect, but perhaps underappreciated. It's the only skyscraper Wright designed that actually became realized, and stands to this day as his tallest structure ever at 221 feet. Wright always had a penchant for low houses, prairie textile block, Usonian, that blended in with nature. So Wright purists may not rank the Price Tower as one of his finer works, but its unique structure of copper and concrete and its prominence on an otherwise flat space of Oklahoma should not be overlooked. The legacy of the building is maintained today by the Price Tower Arts Center, which offers tours. Kentucky Knob, Chalk Hill, Pennsylvania. Located just 4 miles away from the famed Falling Water, Kentucky Knob can be overshadowed at times. The building was additionally constructed toward the end of Wright's life at 86, when he was working on New York's Guggenheim Museum, one of Wright's other frequently cited masterpieces. But Kentucky Knob is also distinguished with its hexagonal design, which renders the home in a crescent shape. The structure, tucked in the Pennsylvania woods, would be one of Wright's final homes designed and was one of the capstones of Wright's illustrious career. A New Way of Seeing the Apollo Moon Missions by Jeffrey Kluger. The moon never gets old. Never mind the 4.5 billion years it's been around. The pictures it yielded during the visits by America's Apollo crews in the 1960s and 1970s are eternally thrilling, especially when they get the occasional updating and refreshing. One such new look has been provided by photographer and filmmaker Christian Stengel, who has released a short composite film of the lunar journeys as they have never been seen before. Stengel began with NASA's Project Apollo archive, a trove of more than 14,000 images from all of the flights in the Apollo program. To bring the images to life so that they produced a coherent, fluid film, he relied on two principal techniques: panoramic stitching, in which he assembled 10 or more images taken across a single landscape and then passed the camera gaze over the whole that resulted, and stop-motion sequences, in which he chose a handful of images that captured a sequence of movements and then combined and time-stretched them so that they stirred into life. Some of the images could never have been captured in real life. No astronaut ever spacewalked away from the docked lunar module and Apollo orbiter to take them in a single frame. Instead, portions of various images were assembled into one. "I created what is essentially an animated collage," said Stengel. "It's the animated part that makes it so remarkable."
Three Questions We Still Have After James Comey's Testimony by Dan Hirschhorn. During one of the most anticipated moments in Washington in years, former FBI Director James Comey had a lot to say. He acknowledged that he orchestrated the leak of his own memo after President Donald Trump fired him. He indicated that the special counsel appointed partly because of that leak will look at whether Trump obstructed justice. He revealed that he felt pressured by President Barack Obama's attorney general to downplay the investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server. And he said that, Lordy, he's not afraid that Trump might have tapes of their conversations. Those were the highlights, but there are many questions still unanswered after Comey left the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing room. Here are three of them. 1. What does Comey know about Jeff Sessions that he can't say? Senators asked many questions that Comey said he couldn't answer in a public setting because of the ongoing investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 election and whether Trump associates colluded in that meddling. But one non-answer stood out more than most. Asked why he didn't report his concerns about Trump's interactions with him to Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Comey said, "Our judgment, as I recall, was that he was very close to and inevitably going to recuse himself for a variety of reasons. We also were aware of facts that I can't discuss in an open setting that would make his continued engagement in a Russia-related investigation problematic, and so we were convinced, and in fact, I think we had already heard that the career people were recommending that he recuse himself, that he was not going to be in contact with Russia-related matters much longer. That turned out to be the case. Sessions recused himself because of his own undisclosed contacts with a Russian official. That recusal, which eventually led to the appointment of Special Counsel Robert Mueller to oversee the Russia probe, has reportedly infuriated Trump, so much so that Sessions reportedly offered to resign. The White House said Thursday that Trump has confidence in Sessions, but it remains unclear what Comey couldn't testify about Sessions publicly. As Michael Isikoff tweeted, "More problems for Sessions? We were aware of facts I can't discuss in open setting that would make his involvement in probe problematic." From Jen Psaki, "Uh-oh, AG Sessions, never good when details about why you had to recuse from ongoing investigation can't be discussed during open hearing." 2. Does Trump have a secret taping system? It's been a question ever since Trump tweeted in May that Comey better hope there are no tapes of our conversations before he starts leaking to the press. On Thursday, Comey made clear that he hopes there actually are such tapes. Meanwhile, at a White House briefing that took place while Comey was still testifying, Trump spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked if there's a White House taping system. "I have no idea," she said. Asked if she could find out, she responded, "Sure, I'll try to look under the couches." And 3, did Trump obstruct justice or not? That's the million-dollar question. Comey publicly made clear for the first time that he feels he was fired because of the Russia investigation that has so bedeviled Trump and his young presidency. But does that or Trump's alleged urging that Comey drop the investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn amount to obstruction of justice? If Comey thinks so, he's not saying, leaving it instead for Mueller to determine. "I don't know," Comey said. "That's Bob Mueller's job to sort that out." Abby Wambach, "I Know What It's Like to Be Judged for Not Looking Like Other Girls" by Abby Wambach. A few days ago, I saw that my former teammate, Mia Hamm, had tweeted about 8-year-old Millie Hernandez, whose soccer team was disqualified from a tournament in Nebraska after officials insisted she was a boy. I can relate to what Millie is going through. I understand what it's like to get weird looks in women's bathrooms. I understand what it's like to be judged for not looking like other girls. And I definitely remember being hit with a lightning bolt of shame and embarrassment the first time someone told me I looked like a boy. Our society uses labels to make people feel safe, but all it does is make those of us who don't fit into those labels feel alone. I don't want Millie to ever feel bad about expressing herself. Because guess what? Our differences are often what make us successful. I know that the differences I brought to the table contributed to my success on the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team. It's utter bullshit that women are only valued or judged by the way they look, while men are almost always judged by their talent and skill. This happens because young girls and boys have historically been given poisonous messages about what it means to be a boy and what it means to be a girl. And these messages have become part of our societal structure. This is about more than just playing in a soccer tournament. This is about the message we're sending to an 8-year-old girl. The adults in this situation didn't do their due diligence to protect a child's feelings, which should be the most important consideration. Now, Millie may have to deal with bullying from others and the embarrassment that comes from being thrust into the spotlight. Millie had to tell the world, "Just because I look like a boy doesn't mean I am a boy." That's not something she or any young girl should have to do. Millie doesn't look like a boy. She looks like Millie. As we continue to evolve, I hope that more people will embrace the idea that gender is on a spectrum and that each of us is going to fall in a different place. How we present ourselves to the world doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is that we're true to ourselves. That's what we need to teach our kids. Young girls, whether they have long hair, short hair, brown skin, light skin, blue eyes, brown eyes, should be able to express themselves however they want. The Millie Hernandezes of the world need to know that they're not alone. Their situation will be better because women before them have fought these battles and will walk beside them. I'll be damned if Millie has to walk the same road I did. I persevered through stereotypes and judgment so that her path could be a little bit easier than mine. As told to by Samantha Cooney. Abby Wambach is the all-time leading scorer in international soccer history and helped lead the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team to Olympic gold medals in 2004, 2012, and the 2015 World Cup. 7 Great Podcasts That Will Teach You Something About Money by Alicia Adamczyk. How well do you know your own money? According to a 2017 survey from finance site GoBankingRates, nearly 40% of Americans can't describe a 401k, and just 36% of 18 to 24-year-olds know what CD stands for. It's a certificate of deposit, by the way. Needless to say, Americans are woefully undereducated about personal finance. Luckily, there's a fairly simple way to start learning the financial basics. Start listening to podcasts. Effort is minimal. Plug in some headphones, download on your phone or computer, click play. And for personal finance specifically, there's a range of informative and entertaining selections. Here's our pick for the 7 best. Number 1, the OG, Planet Money. NPR's Planet Money is a biweekly podcast that spun off a highly lauded 2008 episode of This American Life about the financial crisis. If you're new to the podcast, start there. You've never heard the reasons behind the biggest recession of the last 50 years explained more clearly. Other standouts include a series on following oil from the refinery process to someone's car, and another on tracking how a T-shirt is made from beginning to end through the global economy. Number 2, The New Player, Bad with Money. Hosted by comedian Gabby Dunn, Bad with Money explores the social and emotional facets of money, particularly as they relate to a younger generation. Freelancing, social status, how your parents messed up your relationship to money, Dunn isn't afraid to get personal, and the podcast is all the better for it. Now in its 2nd season, the first had 24 episodes, Bad with Money does an excellent job coupling relevant advice and insight with Dunn's general skepticism and criticism of the financial system we all find ourselves trying to navigate. While all of the episodes feature fascinating conversations with a range of different people and professionals, don't miss the 2nd episode of the 1st season, in which Dunn sits down with a financial psychologist. Number 3, For the Investor, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. hosted by Jake Seward, who interviews a rotating cast of Goldman Sachs employees, exchange isn't exactly for beginners. But if you have a fairly firm grasp on the basics and you want to get more into the nitty-gritty of investing, this podcast is for you. You're not going to get a story, per se, but if you want the scoop on what Brexit means for your portfolio, or whether it's a good time to look into socially conscious ETFs, there are few better sources. Number 4. Dissecting the news, Slate Money. Fusion's Felix Salmon hosts the weekly Slate Money podcast, joined most frequently by emerging markets expert Anna Zamansky and Slate Moneybox columnist Jordan Weissman. The trio breaks down the week's biggest money-related stories, whether that's former Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer's voluminous golden parachute, the future of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the economics of craft beer. Number 5. Best Storytelling, Death, Sex, and Money. Death, Sex, and Money is a bi-monthly podcast hosted by Anna Sales and produced by WNYC Studios, New York's NPR affiliate. Along the lines of Bad with Money, this podcast focuses on unique, potentially taboo stories touching on, well, death, sex, or money, or all three. Come for the discussions of the financial pitfalls of living alone. Stay for the stories about listeners' near-death experiences. Standout money episodes include The Sex Worker Next Door and I Had Babies to Pay for My Baby. Number 6. For the Job Seeker, First Day Back. Everyone can identify with the emotions one experiences on the first day of a new job, and that's exactly what Montreal filmmaker Tali Abacasis details in the first season of First Day Back, a podcast about her experiences getting back into work after a 6-year break. My career is feeling too far away, and I'm losing track of that other part of myself, Abacasis says at the beginning of the first episode. A notion familiar to many moms and dads in the U.S. who have put their work aside to care for their families. Through the 10 episodes, which are meant to be listened to in order, Abacasis weaves her own stories and interviews with others going through similar experiences. And number 7, Deep Take, Vox's The Weeds. The Weeds is a policy podcast hosted by Ezra Klein, Matthew Iglesias, and Sarah Cliff of Vox. These self-proclaimed wonks go deeper on different issues each week, not all of which are strictly money-related. This podcast leans left and can run over an hour, but each episode offers a wide range of discussions, from universal basic income debates to what's in the latest healthcare bill. If you want to learn some of the nuances of core U.S. economic policy issues, it's worth your time. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.